This is an example from the Old Testament that the Passover was celebrated each year. The children asked, what does this mean? See that? Then there you have the doctrine.
Right.
What does the drama mean?
Right. Why this?
And not what does it mean to me?
Exactly.
That's a huge point.
Yeah.
Huge point.
Isn't that what we find in the New Testament? The Gospels tell us what happened. The epistles tell us what it meant. He was crucified for our sins. On this edition of The White Horse Inn, we'll be continuing our discussion of dogma. The White Horse Inn, know what you believe and why you believe it.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Although it's the study of God, theology has a reputation for being dry, abstract, and irrelevant for daily living. Many Christians assume that we can just experience God in a personal relationship apart from doctrine. But that's really impossible. You can't experience God without knowing who He is, what He's done, and who you are in relationship to Him. And in this regard especially, Christianity is a unique religion. The starting point and end game of the Christian faith are distinct from every other way people tend to approach religion and spirituality. Today, especially in our culture, most people tend to associate religion with the inner realm of the individual soul, mysticism, or with principles for individual or social behavior, morality, or perhaps, though less often these days, with intellectual curiosity and speculation, philosophy. Mix elements of these three, mysticism, morality, and philosophy, mix them all together and stir in a generous dose of Yankee pragmatism, and the result is an eclectic soup that's easy to swallow. The goal of life is often viewed as some form of personal or collective happiness. If a person can mix in a little bit of wisdom from various other perspectives to spice things up, all the better. The faith that springs from the Bible's story of God is entirely different. It even has a completely different horizon. In this program, we're going to see how Christian theology, Christian teaching, is not suspended in midair. It's not based on personal, individual, subjective experience. It is a story. It happens to be a true story, but it's a story that gives rise to doctrines, which then give rise to doxology and discipleship. In other words, it's precisely theology that gives us a reason to live the way we do differently in this world because of who God is and what He's done for us. And so in this program, we're going to be focusing on the importance of knowing God for experiencing and following God. You're listening to The White Horse Inn with your usual hosts here, Kim Riddlebarger, Ken Jones, and Rod Rosenblatt, and I'm Mike Horton. Gentlemen, first of all, the Christian faith is not a collection of axioms like all unmarried men are bachelors, a triangle has three sides. Christianity is not made up of a bunch of eternal, universal, timeless truths. If you look at the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed, it's all this happened, then this happened, then that happened. The Christian faith is completely historical, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a story. It's an account of what happened. God was in Christ reconciling the world to Himself, and it takes place from Genesis to Revelation over a span of several millennia and deals with everything from humanity's creation and fall to humanity's redemption and all of the various turns and twists along the way. And it's a great story.
So if you ask a Buddhist what Buddhism is, they'll be inclined to start out by saying, well, the universe is dot, 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 and there are principles that work like this, dot,
yes.
dot, dot. Islam, well, submission to Allah, and this is what it entails. But if you ask a Christian what essentially Christianity is, the appropriate answer is, well, first, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and then this happened. He entered into a covenant with Adam on behalf of all of humanity, and this is how it turned out. But in spite of that, God did this. And you read some of the Psalms, and they recapitulate that whole story. Mm-hmm. Well, Israel did what Adam did, but then God came back with the gospel, and in the last days, he's going to do this. Mm-hmm. That's over and over again. You don't get these eternal, timeless truths with history as a cycle. You get
an impediment.
Yes, yeah. I think that's very important, Kim. Christianity doesn't do well when people are disinterested in history. It happens to be what God chose.
This happened and that happened.
That may very well be why the church is in the fix it is in the United States in this current period of time, because people here are just simply not interested in history.
Yeah. So it's not primarily about principles. It's about things that happened that changed the face of history.
What God did.
Yeah, and you know, the irony, of course, is that when you understand that, as you're expressing it here, it makes sense of those other issues that people tend to make the heart of religion, the principles, you know, the way to live, the why we do it. All of that flows out of the meta-narrative, that overarching story of the power of God unto salvation, or even the purpose of salvation.
Right.
If we understand it, if we begin there, but if you begin with those principles or just a solution for this particular issue, this, and try to make a one-to-one correlation, what we have seen is what we will continue to see, and that's people missing it all the time.
Someone comes in and says, don't bother me with any history or any story. I just want X.
Yeah.
We're not going to help them.
We won't be of much help to you.
Yeah. You got to come being willing to let the Bible give you new questions.
Mm. Yeah.
Not
yeah.
just give you answers to questions you already have.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
The best stories are so rich that they generate much more than a story. They generate deepest convictions that give rise to a certain response that internalizes that history and those truths.
And for good reason.
For good reason, and then transforms our lives in the world.
Yeah, a good case for that would be just the word good news. Mm. When someone comes and brings good news, it transforms those who hear it. For example, marathon runner comes in and says, we just won the battle. The X, Y, and Z army's been defeated. They're fleeing. That has a certain set of dramatic impact upon everything I do.
People jump in the air.
Yeah, exactly.
Exclaiming.
Yeah. But it changes how I live as well.
Right.
And it changes my attitude. If the same runner comes and says, you got 10 minutes, they're over the hill, everything changes with that news as well, and that's not good news.
See, here's the thing. Christianity is self-conscious about the fact that it's a story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Postmodernism, this is an important point, because I think a lot of people say postmodernism is criticizing any big story, but they're not. Postmodernism is criticizing a meta-narrative, that is a story that pretends that it's not a story, like Marxism.
Oh, right. Is that it?
Yeah. Marxism, for example, or capitalism pretend that in some kind of Hegelian way, history is just this in embryo, and we're moving toward it, and the consummation of history is worldwide democracy or worldwide capitalism or worldwide Marxism. And this is just scientific. Naturalism is a meta-narrative.
Yes.
Religions have stories, but we are just telling you the way it is. Mm-hmm. That's the major criticism of people like Lyotard when they coined that postmodernism as incredulity toward meta-narrative. Well, Christianity is self-conscious that it's a story. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is John Levinson at Harvard, a Jewish scholar there, says, for Jews, it is first of all the true story that happened that defines us, and then it's something we internalize. Whereas with Gentiles, it's something that each person internalizes, and then it becomes their story. We do internalize it,
sure.
But what we internalize, he says, is a story about our people,
right?
Rather than our people being the sum total of all the stories that right. we've made up about ourselves. Very similar, isn't it, to the way the New Testament, as well as the Old Testament, talks about the truth that we affirm as the gospel. The heart of Christianity is not good advice, good mm-hmm. principles, good mm-hmm. government, good this, good that, mm-hmm. but good news, an announcement right. about yeah. what God has done.
Right.
This is an example from the Old Testament that the Passover was celebrated each year. And each participant was told to think of himself or herself as having passed through the Red Sea. Mm-hmm. See, there's that, again, mm-hmm. your story being swept into a larger story than yourself instead of reducing that larger story to your own personal right, life history.
Right, right.
The children asked, what does this mean? See, that then there you have the doctrine.
Right.
What does the drama mean?
Right. Why mm-hmm. this?
And not what does it mean to me?
Exactly.
That's a huge
yeah.
point.
Yes. Yeah.
Huge point.
Isn't that what we find in the New Testament? The Gospels tell us what happened. The Epistles tell us what it meant.
Yes.
The Gospels primarily focus on he was crucified outside the gates of Jerusalem, mm-hmm. was raised from the dead after having been buried for 3 days. And then the epistles tell us especially why. He was crucified for our sins.
Right.
Unpack that. Raised for our justification. Mm-hmm. Unpack that. And then Paul gets to the Alpine summits, thinking especially of Romans, where he says, how shall we respond to all of this? If God yeah. is for us, who can be against us? Mm-hmm. Who shall separate us from the love of God? And he's breathless yeah. in exulting. And it's really at that point of getting it. You can tell that Paul himself was so taken with the doctrines that arise out of that drama. He saw himself as the beneficiary of yes. that story he was telling to such an extent, all he could do was stop like a hiker at an alpine vista and look out and
marvel
mm-hmm. in praise and thanksgiving. Yeah.
Doxology.
Yeah. And then he says, now, in view of all these mercies, yeah. present your bodies as a living sacrifice. Mm-hmm. No longer be conformed to this world's way of thinking, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Always pointing back to the drama mm-hmm. that gives rise to the doctrines. So in this view of things, isn't it the doctrine that far from being dry and abstract, though it can be taught that way, it's the doctrine that draws me into the story that tells me how this story that happened so long ago impacts me.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
He was not only crucified and raised, that's interesting,
yeah.
but he was crucified for my sins
right.
and raised
right.
for my justification. If you don't have the doctrine...
That's a bit more than something that's just interesting.
Yeah.
Yes.
If you don't have the doctrine, then it doesn't mean anything for you.
Right.
But people tend to think doctrine is the opposite of what does this mean for you.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
That's the irony.
Yeah.
Well, and also in the story element of the gospel, something that you said, Mike, years ago that stays with me, and that is you said when people talk about humanity, we usually start at the wrong place. We begin at the fall. And if we understand the story of the plot line of the scriptures, we don't begin with the fall. We begin with the beauty of creation.
Yes.
So even in terms of defining relationship, which is recovered in the gospel with a right relationship with God, we are to see Adam prior to the fall mm-hmm. as the aim of human existence, pointing towards something else, something that's greater, that's going to be accomplished in Christ, this eternal felicity and relationship between the image bearer and the one whose image we bear. But we begin, if you look in those first couple of chapters of Genesis, there's this relationship between God and man that none of us have experienced outside of Christ.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Heavens, yeah. then,
that Adam didn't experience.
That they walked yes. together in the cool of the day.
Yes.
Just amazing.
And the point here, too, is that everybody has a drama. For instance, you know, Marxism would say it's not a drama, it's just the way things are. It's not dogmas. It's just scientific principles.
Well, and the famous economist Joseph Schumpeter did a very good job in his criticism of Marx by basically showing it's a parody of Christianity.
Yeah, with eschatological heresy.
It is, yeah. And Schumpeter was an atheist and saw that Marxism was a religion.
Mm. Yeah, it really, that's one way we can give thanks for postmodernism and its criticism of the modern hubris that creates all of these ideological movements that pretend they're not dogmatic, and yet millions are murdered over the dogma.
Right. Yep.
And they don't have a story, and yet the narrative that they tell moves armies. I saw a CNN report, an interview with a gentleman who was raised in a North Korean prison camp, concentration camp.
Yeah. And escaped?
And escaped.
Yeah.
He never had spent one day outside of the concentration camp. Yep. And he said that he never really spent any time with his parents, was not allowed to spend time with his parents. He was born in the camp. Everyone was separated. And his parents weren't pulling their weight, and so he turned them in.
Wow. Mm. Yeah, I saw that story.
And his mother was hanged, and his father was shot, and his brother was shot. And he said he felt at that time no remorse. He knew nothing else. And this was good for the party. This was good for the nation. For the great leader, he says he never felt love. He never knew what love was.
Mm-hmm.
He never imagined that life outside the camp was any different from what he had experienced inside the concentration camp.
That's all he knew.
Yeah.
That's all he knew. To hear this interview is really heartbreaking. And now he's saying it's not just about getting hamburgers and Cokes. This is about understanding what being a human being is.
Mm-hmm.
There you see a clear sense in which a bad story can ruin your life.
Sure.
Hmm.
We indwell stories. They're not just bedtime things we read to our kids.
Right.
We live in the story of the world.
Yeah.
And Marxism is one of those stories. Capitalism is one of those stories. Well, we'll just be happy if everybody in the world has free markets, ultimate happiness and joy. Even to take things that are true in a penultimate sense
and
raise them to the level of nirvana is a way we delude ourselves.
Yeah. There's no imagine. You know, we can't, because of Christianity's story, we can't sing John Lennon's Imagine a World That Doesn't Exist, because there is a world that does exist. And Schaeffer said, Francis Schaeffer made the great point that, you know, one of the things we as Christians have to do is to make sure we realize we live in a world that God has made, and we can't live in a pretend world. And one of the great features of his apologetic was to bring the roof down, taking the roof off, as he called it, by making sure that non-Christians understand that they can't invent a world and live in that world because they live in the world that God made. And they live in God's story whether they like it or not. And they'll deny it till the end, but there is no imagine for them.
This is the only world there is.
This is the world there is.
This is a story, but it happens to be the true story.
Yeah, and our personal experience and our personal existence has to be seen in light of a greater
existence.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. And that's what I think the being sequestered into personal experiences, that's what gets lost. The overarching purpose, there's a greater existence, and you are part of something else.
I wonder how much of this would collapse if you say the United States experienced some sort of economic crisis, some sort of military crisis. You know, what happens if we get home from taping and we find out that a major city in the United States has been nuked? Can our story explain that? Can we deal with that? And this subjective paradigm can't deal with that at all, because the person who hasn't been nuked doesn't care that somebody else across the country has been nuked. But I have to care that someone across the United States has been nuked, because that influences the whole story of all of us.
Yeah, so it's not just Christianity that has drama, doctrines that arise out of it, doxology arising out of that, and then discipleship as the result. That's true of all, not just religions, but of all ideologies. For instance, when Paul says that first of all, Gentiles, the first couple of chapters of Romans, Gentiles no longer recognized the true God, the creator God, as the real God, but gave their allegiance to idols.
Mm.
So they basically handed over the biblical story that they know is true when it comes to the creator and lawgiver. They suppress that truth in unrighteousness, that drama and that doctrine. They suppress in unrighteousness. And then he says the essence of sin is they were no longer thankful.
That is
the essence of the doxology or the form of worship that comes out of idolatry is we no longer are thankful to the Creator who made us.
And the
we
great,
are rebellious.
The great irony of Paul's conclusion there is that you're enslaved to something that can't talk, that can't speak, that has no life, that you've made with your own hands.
Yeah.
And
what
you've enslaved yourself to what could be sillier than inventing something and enslaving yourself to it?
It's irrational.
And ascribing to the creature that which belongs to the Creator.
Yes.
Right. And in contrast, the gospel, the good news, leads us to exclaim, who has ever given God anything that God should repay him? For from him and to him and through him are all things, to whom be the glory forever. So the gospel story, the drama, giving rise to these doctrines of justification, sanctification, glorification, gives us thankfulness back.
Finally,
I can mourn in this world. I can face the world as it really is with all of its sin and misery. I can look at myself and say, oh, wretched man that I am. But then I can look away from myself and say, oh, but thanks be to God through Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm. What you've just described is somebody who's been restored from a religion of self. To now being part of God's story and having God's story change that self, mold that self.
The three critical elements in God's story is creator, creation, and creature.
Yeah.
Those are the three elements. And
the characters.
Yes, those are the three characters that we're introduced to in the first couple of chapters in Genesis. And the Creator has created with a particular purpose. The creation serves that purpose. And the creation, that's the theater in which we by which we have relationship with God. Mm-hmm. If the creature is disconnected from that greater story and purpose of the Creator and the creation, then we end up with all of the stuff we end up with.
Friedrich Nietzsche, the great philosopher, turn of the 20th, said that it's the Bible that gives rise to the idea of history. It's not just that everything in the Bible happens in history. It gave rise to the very idea of history with the tick of Genesis to the talk of the book of Revelation.
Wow, what a great line.
Yeah. But what's interesting is, because he embraced a cyclical view instead of a historical
eternal
view.
Return.
He says, basically, with God dead, that history rolls back into itself, turns back into a circle. And he said, look, a lot of people are lamenting that. A lot of people are saying it's tragic that God is dead. I'm glad that the Bible that gave rise to history is the fading memory. I'm glad that this God is dead, because he says, now, not having a purpose for my life, no great origin and no great destiny posited for me by someone else, I can create one for myself.
Yeah.
Well, that might sound Promethean, but that's exactly, I think, the way we, by nature, all of us, have thought since the fall, and it's in our culture in spades.
Yes, it sure is.
Yeah.
This is really what you see on the streets all the time.
Yep.
I can choose what I want. I can become whoever I want to be. I can cross all boundaries, even natural boundaries, in order to be something that is unnatural.
Yeah.
And that's okay, because I can determine who I'm going to be. There is no creator God who made nature a certain way. There is no redeemer God who is taking history in a certain direction. Free play. It's recess.
I'm reminded of Neil Gaiman's Life, the movie.
He does
a great job of defining that as people, for example, will see a character in a TV program or a movie they like, and they'll emulate that person, mold their life, they'll dress like that. That person doesn't exist in real life.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. This is from Roger Ebert, the film critic who died recently. He and Gene Siskel, of course, were famous partners in their movie criticism. And Siskel was raised in a traditional Jewish home, and Ebert was raised Catholic. But they both came to similar sort of humanistic convictions toward the end of their life. Ebert tells the story of when he sat down with Siskel one night for dinner and started talking philosophy. He says, we talked about life and death, the cosmos, our place in the grand scheme of things. Now, that's exactly what we're talking about.
Sure.
Drama, doctrine, doxology, mm-hmm. discipleship. We talked about this whole story that we're indwelling, the meaning of it all. There was a reason Gene studied philosophy. He was a natural. He spoke about his Judaism, which he took very seriously. His parents had started one of the early synagogues in the North Shore after World War II. Quote, I had a lot of long talks with my father about our religion, Gene told me. He said it wasn't necessary to think too much about an afterlife. What was important was this life, how we live it, what we contribute, our families, and the memories we leave. Gene said, the importance of Judaism isn't simply theological, or in the minds of some Jews necessarily theological at all. Mm-hmm. It's that we have stayed together and respected these things for thousands of years. And so it is important that we continue. In a few words, this was one of the most touching descriptions of Judaism I had ever heard. Ebert also wrote with great sensitivity about his Catholic school upbringing and his struggle with faith in God. Despite his skeptical beliefs, religion was an object of fascination for him, a class he considered a favorite subject. In a personal essay for the Chicago Sun-Times, How I Believe in God, he pontificated about his religious and spiritual beliefs, elucidating the moral code he adopted from the church. Catholicism made me a humanist before I knew the word, he wrote. Our theology was very practical. All men are created equal. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The Ten Commandments, which we studied at length, except for adultery, quote, which you children don't have to worry about. A fair day's work for a fair day's wage. A good government should help make sure everyone has a roof over their head, a job, and three meals a day. The cardinal acts of mercy. Ethical behavior. The sisters didn't especially seem to think that a woman's place was in the home, as theirs certainly wasn't. You should pray for your vocation. My mother prayed for mine. She wanted me to become a priest. Every Catholic mother hopes she can give a son to the priesthood, she said, and spoke of one mother at St. Patrick's who'd given two, as if she were a lottery winner. His so-called secular humanism, though he eschewed labels, made him comfortable with religious behavioral principles, but not theological ones. I believe in the basic church teachings because I thought they were correct, he says, not because God wanted me to. Through his life, he stubbornly struggled with the existence of God, explaining his personal theology in a way that lay plain his confusion. If I were to say I don't believe God exists, that wouldn't mean I believe God doesn't exist, nor does it mean I don't know, which implies that I could know. Despite his identification with Catholic teachings, however, he resisted religious conformity and was honest about his contradictory impulses. He admitted to spending hours and hours in churches all over the world, not to engage in prayer, of course, but to nudge his thoughts towards wonder and awe. The angels of his religious nature ultimately won out, since he clearly had a spiritual bent, but he also felt a substantial degree of institutional disillusionment. Mm. Quote, I have no interest in megachurches with jocular millionaire pastors, he wrote. I think what happens in them is socio-political, not spiritual. Still, when recounting a childhood tale of a priest who comforted a young Ebert by holding him in his lap, he reassured readers, no priest or nun ever treated me with other than love and care. I am not a believer, he said, not an atheist, not an agnostic. I am still awake.
Wow.
Very well, besides being well written, really expresses where a lot of people are.
I think that's very poignant.
Spiritual, not religious.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. And that's
obviously turned off to evangelical megachurch Christianity.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And yet not one sense of redemption in any of it.
There it is.
Right.
It's all ethical.
It's all ethics.
And in fact, explicitly said,
yes,
not theological,
yep,
but moral.
Yeah.
But all the Catholic social teaching was embraced as though it were biblical.
As if it were gospel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If you really want a religion that's spiritual, not religious, that's about experience rather than doctrine.
Yeah, and that
go to Buddhism or Hinduism, not Christianity.
Yeah, Christianity won't help you.
Well, unfortunately, Christianity, as it's morphed has given an answer to that. In fact, there's a renegade brand of Christianity that the very sort of thing that we're talking about, a Christianity without theology, is an effort to be spiritual without being religious. I think that's one of the reasons you have the emphasis on the informal when it comes to worship, trying to remove all of the exterior things that resemble some sort of order or higher or overarching authority or anything that binds it, so that you are just free to be you. And people, there are a lot of churches that advertise that come to a place where you are free to be you. But I think that is the Christian version, the contemporary Christian version of being spiritual without being religious. And that hyper-Pentecostalism, where we have movements of the Holy Spirit apart from appointed means, falls right into that.
The thing I noticed in all of this is what Kim noticed, is the absence of Christ.
Yeah. Right.
There is no need for redemption, evidently.
Yeah.
The secularist writers and filmmakers, some of them get that, but those who've been reared in churches that are primarily moral or something else don't.
Yeah.
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 It's significant by its absence.
Yeah. This is what's so interesting. You know, Paul in Mars Hill in Athens is addressing the greatest philosophers of his day, divided primarily into the Stoics and the Epicureans.
Mm-hmm.
And the Stoics especially emphasized that there are these natural laws that are operative in the world. Stoicism was a philosophy of eternal, timeless principles, not of historical arguments.
Right.
And
he focuses on them, not the hedonists.
He really does. He goes for the
Stoics.
Yeah. And it's interesting that he compares those who basically turn the Abrahamic faith into a religion of legalism, works righteousness. He tells them that the law in which they are trusting is the stoicheia tou kosmou, the elementary principles of the world, which is precisely what he identifies as pagan philosophy. If you trust in works righteousness rather than the gospel that he is announcing, even if it comes from the lips of Moses, it is equivalent to the natural law of pagan philosophers.
Yeah.
That is an amazing statement in Galatians and Colossians.
It sure is.
But the equivalent to that is karma in the Eastern religions.
Right.
Stoicheia tou kosmou. Things just, what goes around comes around.
Yep.
If you give, it'll come back to you.
Yep.
Reciprocity principle.
That is as dogmatic as anything else. But Rod, to your point, whether it's Catholicism, Protestantism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Judaism, what all of religion shares in common, apart from the gospel, is that it's how we live, not what we believe. It's deeds, not creeds.
Yep.
It's inner experience, not external proclamation.
Contemplation and not belief.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
Ebert, as wonderful as that was, he's standing back and he's not engaging with any of it.
Right.
There's this sense in which I'm above it all.
Yeah.
I don't need it. It's interesting to me, but. And I view, you know, my job as a pastor is to prepare people to face that moment when they die.
Sure.
Yeah.
Because there is something that is imminent.
To take a courageous and realistic look at the situation.
Yeah. Well, as Kim, you had mentioned the absence of redemption. And again, this is where when the church gets the message right, when we get the story right, there is in the message of redemption, the redemption that is in Christ, a redemption of all that the Creator has intended for His image-bearing creatures.
Including the things they're looking for.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And
they'll
be given them.
Yeah.
They'll be given them.
Yes.
You'll find what you're looking for.
You get the love. You get the joy.
Exactly.
You get the...
C.S. Lewis used to write that it's in the self-dying that you're going to get your real self given back to you. You just don't believe it.
I think of Jesus' words to the Jews in John chapter 6 when he's trying to explain why he's a living bread that came down from heaven. If you eat of this bread, you'll never be hungry or thirsty again. And they're thinking, well, Jesus, you're just talking about bread that won't get moldy.
Hmm.
You know, and they just miss that whole point that he will give us
The ultimate bread.
The ultimate bread, that satisfies the deepest human needs forever.
Yeah. The thing that we're saying kind of unites all these religious perspectives apart from the gospel as the grand story can be boiled down to karma, or what Paul calls the elementary principles of the world. Here is an excerpt from Bono in conversation with Mishka Assayas, an interview, Grace Over Karma. Bono says, "There's nothing hippie about my picture of Christ. The Gospels paint a picture of a very demanding, sometimes divisive love, but love it is. I accept the Old Testament as an action movie, blood, car chases, evacuations, a lot of special effects, sea dividing, mass murder, adultery. The children of God are running amok, wayward. Maybe that's why they're so relatable. The New Testament gives us Jesus who looks familiar, horizontal. The combination of all of this is what makes the cross." Assayas, "I think I'm beginning to understand religion because I've started acting and thinking like a father. What do you make of that?" Bono, "Yes, I think it's normal. It's a mind-blowing concept that the God who created the universe might be looking for company, a real relationship with people. But the thing that keeps me on my knees is the difference between karma and grace." Assayas, "I haven't heard you talk about that." Bono, "Well, I really believe we've moved out of the realm of karma into one of grace." Assayas, "That doesn't make it clearer for me." Bono, "You see, at the center of all religions is the idea of karma. You know, what you put out comes back to you, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, or in physics. In physical laws, every action is met by an equal or opposite reaction. It's clear to me that karma is at the very heart of the universe. I'm absolutely sure of it. And yet along comes this idea called grace to upend all that as you reap, so you sow stuff. Grace defies reason and logic. Love interrupts, if you like, the consequences of your actions, which in my case is very good news indeed because I've done a lot of stupid things." Assayas, "I'd be interested to hear that." Bono, "That's between me and God. But I'd be in big trouble if karma were finally going to be my judge." Mm-hmm. "It doesn't excuse my mistakes, but I'm holding out for grace. I'm holding out that Jesus took my sins onto himself on the cross because I know who I am, and I hope I don't have to depend on my own religiosity." Assayas, "The Son of God who takes away the sins of the world, I wish I could believe in that." Bono, "Yes, the sacrificial lamb. I love that God says, look, you cretins, there are certain results to the way we are, to selfishness, and there's mortality. It's part of your sinful nature. And let's face it, you're not living a very good life now, are you? There are consequences to actions. The point of the death of Christ is that he took on the sins of the world so that what we put out didn't come back to us, and that our sinful nature doesn't reap the obvious death. That's the point, and it should keep us humbled. It's not our good works that get us through the gates of heaven." Assayas, "Well, that's a great idea, no denying it. Such great hope is wonderful, even though it's close to lunacy in my view. Christ has his rank among the world's great thinkers, to be sure, but Son of God isn't that far-fetched?" Bono, "No, it's not far-fetched. Look, the secular response to the Christ story always goes like this. He was a great prophet, obviously a very interesting guy, had a lot to say along the lines of other great prophets, be they Elijah, Muhammad, Buddha, or Confucius. But actually, Christ doesn't allow you to do that. He doesn't let you off that hook. Christ says, no, I'm not saying I'm a teacher. Don't call me a teacher. I'm not saying I'm a prophet. I'm saying I'm the Messiah. I'm saying I'm God incarnate. And people say, no, 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 please just be a prophet. A prophet we can take. You're a bit eccentric. We've had John the Baptist eating locusts and wild honey. We can handle that. But don't mention the M word because, you know, we're going to have to crucify you. And he goes, no, no, I know you're expecting me to come back with an army and set you free from these creeps, but actually I am the Messiah. At this point, everyone starts staring at their shoes and says, oh my God, he's going to keep saying this. So what you're left with is either Christ was who he said he was, the Messiah, or he's a complete nutcase. I mean, we're talking nutcase on the level of Charles Manson. This man was like some of the people we've been talking about earlier. This man was strapping himself to a bomb and had King of the Jews on his head. And as they were putting him on the cross, was going, okay, martyrdom, here we go. Bring on the pain. I can take it. I'm not joking here. The idea that the entire course of civilization for over half of the globe could have its fate changed and turned upside down by a nutcase, that's far-fetched.
Wow. Wow.
I look at the cross of Christ. What I see up there is all my crap and everyone else's. So I ask myself a question a lot of people have asked. Who is this man? And was he who he said he was? Or just a religious nut? And there it is. That's the question. See, this is the... Doesn't it all come down to this, that it's not just that the Christian story makes sense of things that the other stories don't make sense of?
Very big point.
But that actually the first and foremost, what sets this story apart is it's the only one in which the lead character actually is alive after being dead for 3 days.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the only story in which the lead character is a human being who claims to be God incarnate.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And as you have pointed out, it's a story that breaks in on us.
Yeah.
It's a story that we probably wouldn't have any interest in were it not someone breaking in on us and grabbing us and saying, listen to this story.
Yep. All the other religious leaders down through the ages will give you eternal principles that you can apply to your life so that you can be happier, healthier, more moral, build a better society.
Yep.
Jesus is the only one who, first of all, even says he will redeem you from guilt and hell.
Yes.
And secondly, backs it up by the fact that he rose from the dead.
Yes.
Yeah.
Folks, this is not only the greatest story ever told, this is the true story. Mm-hmm. And it has even Jesus' resurrection to back it up. And it's not just proof that he is who he said he was.
Though it is that.
It's the guarantee that through faith in him, you too will share in his resurrection from the dead. So you won't suffer the karma of getting what's coming to you.
Yeah.
He took what's coming to you.
Yes.
And through faith in him, you can be reconciled to God. That's the greatest, not only story ever told, the greatest news ever told. And boy, if that doesn't lead to doxology and discipleship, a different way of living in the world, I don't know what can.
Yeah.
For those of you who think that theology isn't practical, maybe take a look at a different theology. Maybe take a look at Christianity and the central announcement that it gives. Not more good advice, not more good principles, not more good ideas. But at its heart, the glad tidings of great joy, which is for all people. Look forward to being with you again next time on The White Horse Inn.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. To find out how to support our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also check out the support tab of our website at whitehorseinn.org. That's whitehorseinn.org.